Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Paid $4.15 a gallon for gas the other day. And yes, California gas is always expensive. But have you seen oil prices lately? Have you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 25th day of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The number of the day this Thursday is 75. It's denominated in U.S. dollars and is the price above which the global crude oil benchmark, Brent North Sea, it's called. It hit that price in trading today. Settled just a tad lower, but $75 a barrel ain't nothing to sneeze at. While being cautious about cause and effect declarations here, as we always are, some Russian oil exports were suspended today, and the tightening of U.S. sanctions on Iran are, as you've heard here and elsewhere, imminent, the ultimate aim of which is to take Iranian oil completely out of the global market. Now, one day's fluctuations do not news make, but the trend is clearly up since the beginning of the year when Brent was going for about $53 a barrel. You've seen it at the pump, I'm sure, but if this trend keeps up, a whole lot of other stuff is going to start getting more expensive, too. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has our occasional reminder of exactly what it means to live in an oil-based economy.
Oil is everywhere in this economy. There's the price we pay at the pump, sure, but there's also everything that higher transportation fuel costs feed into, says University of Houston economist Ed Hirsch.
Postal Service, UPS, Coca-Cola, the beer distributors, they don't go out and drive less simply because the price of fuel has gone up. We're going to see that in increased cost at the grocery store and delivery services.
And oil is an important raw material for industries whose products we all buy a lot of, says Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics.
Plastics, chemicals, textiles, fabricated metals. The broader effect on inflation is still small because some of those costs, businesses, they don't pass them all the way through to consumers.
That's partly because companies can deal with oil price fluctuations, says Jacob Kierkegaard at the Peterson Institute. They know this drill. Geopolitical crisis, oil spikes, something else happens, oil falls.
Industrial users of oil, airlines do the same thing, I should add. They tend to be hedged. They know how much oil they need so they can buy, you know, 3, 4, 5 years in advance.
And, of course, rising oil prices are good for some players in the U.S. economy. Remember, we're now the world's biggest oil producer. Stuart Glickman at CFRA Research says from West Texas to North Dakota, they love crude at 60 or 70 a barrel.
If you're a producer, you want prices to be higher, but you don't want it going so high people start driving less and it kills demand. And we have seen that in the past.
Like back in 2008 when crude oil hit $145 a barrel. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A story now nominally about your teeth, but a story that's really more of a corporate strategy thing. We learned today that CVS is taking another step away from just being a retailer and a pharmacy. It's going to partner with Smile Direct Club and a couple of hundred CVSs this year. You're going to be able to go in and get your teeth scanned and evaluated for Smile Direct's teeth straightening services. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains the business idea.
CVS ran a pilot with Smile Direct in a few stores, and here's what happened.
32% of those customers that were coming in for the services had not shopped at that CVS before.
Mally Bernstein is head of beauty for CVS Health.
And so not only were we pulling in that younger consumer, we were also pulling in new consumers.
And those consumers bought stuff at the CVS besides teeth straightening services. This is important because the less CVS looks like a traditional retailer, the less exposure it has to disruptors like Amazon. You can't get your teeth scanned at Amazon.
We want to have more and more reasons to come to the store, and services are a local part of the experience.
Now, for Smile Direct, there's a very clear benefit.
It's going to double our physical retail footprint today.
Alex Fenkel is co-founder of Smile Direct Club.
It's really about being where our customers are.
Being where customers are cheaply. Brandon Couillard is a senior research analyst at Jefferies.
It allows them to not have to spend nearly as much as they would for their own physical retail site.
The CVS deal has another big bonus for both parties. CVS bought health insurer Aetna last year. Soon, Aetna will add SmileDirect to its list of covered in-network providers. So CVS Health hosts SmileDirect, and CVS Health can refer patients to SmileDirect. The deal does open CVS to criticism from orthodontists who dislike SmileDirect's business model, which uses off-site orthodontists to supervise the process and who can't perform full medical exams on patients on-site. Sean Murphy is with the American Association of Orthodontists.
We've filed with the Food and Drug Administration a letter regarding SmileDirect Club, as well as a petition to the United States Federal Trade Commission.
SmileDirect Club's Alex Finkel.
I think whenever you disrupt an industry, there's going to be inherent friction.
In this case, one company, CVS, in an industry that's being disrupted, is partnering with a disruptor in another. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Speaking, as Sabri was, of disrupting, we turn now to American trade policy, new NAFTA, specifically the USMCA, officially. It has yet to be taken up by Congress, which it will eventually have to be, and there are a lot of things holding it up. Domestic politics here, yes, but also domestic politics in Mexico, specifically some promised labor reforms there, organized labor, to be precise, unions, which, in the way that global trade kind of works, is going to affect what Democrats and labor unions here have to say about the trade deal. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains what's going on.
Low-wage workers have been an important driver of Mexico's economy for decades.
At least since the beginning of the first NAFTA in 1994.
Sandra Pulaski is with the International Institute for Sustainable Development. She says one reason wages have stayed so low in Mexico is that unions there have been more aligned with government and company management instead of workers. Also,
corrupt unions that weren't real, that didn't have any members, but that made a contract in order to preclude any unions from getting organized.
The pending reforms, supported by Mexico's new left-leaning president, are set to change that. Gustavo Flores Macias is a professor of government at Cornell University.
At least on paper, unions will be forced to elect their leaders through free and secret ballots. And every 4 years, workers will have to vote explicitly on their collective bargaining agreements. It's a major accomplishment.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats have said these reforms are necessary before Congress can take up the USMCA. And just passing the new law won't be enough. Celeste Drake is a trade specialist at the AFL-CIO, which represents 12 million union workers in the U.S.
So we want to make sure that the labor law reform has been enacted and is being fully implemented. Then we're going to be looking for what are the steps that are being taken to make sure that the regulations are written, to make sure that the inspectors are funded, hired, and trained.
She says the AFL-CIO won't support a vote on the USMCA until it sees these new laws are working. And other labor provisions in the deal have stronger enforcement procedures. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The ticker symbol of the day this Thursday is MSFT, Microsoft, up 3.33% on the day to $1 trillion. All right, I left out a step or two, but Microsoft is now the third company to have topped $1 trillion in market capitalization. Shares did slide into the close. The empire that Bill Gates and Paul Allen built, worth about $990 billion at the bell. How big a deal is a $1 trillion market cap? Meh, I mean, it's a nice number, but Apple and Amazon already hit it, and they've slid back. Elsewhere on Wall Street today, decidedly mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to do a story now about unintended consequences, wrapped up in an update of a piece we did 3 or so months ago. Today makes it 3 months exactly since the longest government shutdown this country has ever seen ended. While it was going on, we talked to a woman named Sunny Blaylock. She's a designer for a government contractor in Arlington, Virginia. Her husband works for the State Department, so both of them stopped getting paychecks when Washington shut down at the end of last year. We called her up the other day to see how things are going.
The shutdown definitely has made us far less risky in our financial choices. Back in December, My husband and I were finally ready to get rid of our last student loan repayment. But when the government shutdown happened, it just made us really nervous. And so I put off paying our last bit of our student loans. There's still that insecurity. You want the cash on hand. My husband and I have both talked about us, maybe at least one of us not working for the government. And we have considered, you know, maybe looking elsewhere. But the truth is, we don't do this work because of the great pay. We do it because we really care about what we do. It's hard to let that go. The perk of a government job in the past was that it was stable. So when that was taken away, it has definitely colored every decision we have. This past week, we went on a trip. We didn't book this trip until very last minute because of the government shutdown. We didn't feel like we could, but we did eventually go on a trip for spring break, which was a big deal for our family. And our kids were nervous when we booked it because they knew that all spending was on lockdown. And while we were on this trip, there was a video arcade. So I gave them both a budget. They both had $5 and they were supposed to go. And my younger one spent $7. And when I came back, I was slightly annoyed. And like a good parent, I was like, you know, hey, buddy, you had a budget. You didn't keep to it. But his reaction and fear of spending money and then overspending was like far more than it should have been. Burst out and cried for 20 minutes because he just felt horrible about spending an extra $2. And I felt sad when I saw that because it shouldn't have been that way. I don't want my kids to have an unhealthy relationship with finances, and I hope that changes in time.
Consider for just a moment retail in this age of e-commerce. You can get almost anything you want, within reason, of course, delivered literally to your doorstep within a couple of days, usually faster. What then can companies do to top that, I hear you asking? Well, I'll tell you what they can do. Personalized products tailored to you, the individual consumer. Ellen Byron wrote about it. She covers retail and consumer habits for the Wall Street Journal. It's good to have you on.
Hi, nice to be here.
So run me through a couple of these. The headline is shampoo, but there are far more products out there that are becoming unbelievably personalized.
Yeah, we're seeing across so many different types of products that we use every day, this drive by companies to create personalized versions of them. So we're seeing it in shampoo, in skin cream, sports drinks, makeup applicators, vitamins, it goes on and on.
Tell me how, just to pick sports drinks, because that's the one I'm probably most familiar with, right? How does Gatorade know what I need in a drink?
Well, they hope that you will tell them. They have created, in partnership with Northwestern University, a wearable sweat patch. So during a workout, you would stick a wearable patch to your arm, and then via a new app, it will read how much you've sweat during that workout and what your sweat content is like. And then based on that, they will tell you exactly which formula you should be drinking in order to, they say, enhance your performance.
Do they work? I mean, take your pick, right? There's a cosmetics thing where you roll like this wand thing on your face and it'll give you a skin diagnosis, and then there's Gatorade and there's shampoo. Do they work? Does it help?
Well, there's a few different things going on. I mean, one is that, yes, you do have different skin concerns than probably the people sitting around you. Your hair issues might be different than someone else's. So more and more consumers are saying, I want something that will work just for what I'm concerned about. They're tired of staring at a crowded aisle of different options, worried about making the wrong choice and throwing that money away. So there are consumers, and I talked to some of them, who would rather spend a few minutes filling out a detailed profile of themselves and what they want versus spending that time in a store.
Why now? Are they doing it now just because they can, because they've got the technology to measure, you know, my sweat?
Well, yeah, there's a few reasons why now. One is there's a lot more manufacturing agility today, and so it's machine-wise more possible than it used to be. Consumers are far more comfortable offering up information about themselves, and they also are tracking more things about themselves. So consumers who are already more comfortable counting how many steps they take or shopping for specific items online, they're more willing to go online for other grocery things that they might buy.
All right. So what about you? Would you pony up for personalized shampoo or a sports drink?
I have to say I'm curious. I mean, there's always room for improvement with my hair. And I will say, you know, there are a lot of people out there who just expect more and more of their life to be catered to them. They want, you know, for their Netflix picks or even when you're shopping, they kind of expect the same thing with the everyday products they use.
Ellen Byron writing in the Wall Street Journal about personalized products from shampoo to almost you name it. Ellen, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks.
Coming up.
It's become something that pretty much all young people do in a way where it used to be kind of an appendage of nerd culture.
How plain old gaming became gamer chic. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 134 points today, a 0.5%, 26,462. The NASDAQ found 16 points, about 0.2%, 81.18. And the S&P 500 down a point, basically flat, 29.26. Manufacturing giant 3M, the maker of Post-it notes, adhesives, and a wide range of pretty much everything else, reported lower than expected profit. Sales outside the U.S. have declined, and the company says it plans to lay off 2,000 workers. Oh, by the by, 3M unglued 12.9% today. Southwest Airlines says it canceled more than 10,000 flights in the first quarter because of grounded Boeing 737 MAX airplanes. Also, had a labor dispute. That's according to Southwest's first quarter profits cost the company. Results still beat Wall Street, so Southwest lifted more than 0.75% today. Yield on the 10-year Treasury, up 2.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity. A how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You got your tickets for the new Avengers movie yet? Endgame is breaking box office records, and it hasn't even officially opened nationwide. It's really only a question of how much of a blockbuster the thing is going to wind up being, which, the other day in our morning news meeting, brought us around to this question. With superhero franchises being the dominant force at the box office the past, decade or so, what do you suppose Hollywood would be like without them? We asked Marketplace's Marielle Segarra to do a little thought experiment.
This is the only way to open this story, right?
In a world where Captain America and T'Challa and Batman never existed, and superhero movies didn't bring in a quarter of box office revenue, Hollywood would be a very different place.
Last year, 6 out of the 10 top-grossing films in North America were superhero movies. Paul DeGarabedian at Comscore says there are good reasons for that.
Superhero movies are extraordinarily cinematic. They're bigger than life. These movies are meant to be seen in a movie theater.
They're what Hollywood needs to get people to switch off Netflix and leave their houses. Also, Charlotte Howell, a media studies professor at Boston University, says the comic books that are the source material for superhero movies lend themselves to the very lucrative practice of franchising.
They have a long history of creating multiple versions of superheroes, multiple universes, multiple what-if spin-off titles.
And that means studios can crank out multiple films and TV shows and podcasts and action figures and video games. But there was a world before superhero films and another genre that used to dominate Hollywood. Wheeler Winston Dixon, who teaches film studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, says that genre once accounted for about half of the movies in theaters.
It had readily recognizable archetypes. These are the good guys. These are the bad guys. Here's the conflict, but the outcome is foretold.
Yep, we're talking about Westerns, which faded away. So Winston Dixon says if we didn't have superhero movies, something else would probably fill the void. Something just like them.
End-of-the-world movies or action movies, like the Die Hard movies where you have heroic angles of skyscrapers and bombs going off and things like that.
But to be clear, he doesn't think the superhero genre is going away anytime soon. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
So here's a question from the last Avengers movie. When, spoiler alert, Thanos, the bad guy, decides to eliminate half of the planet's population at random? Well, because it apparently is Avengers Thought Experiment Day here at Marketplace, we wanted to find out what could happen to an economy when 50% of all people just disappear. You can check it out at marketplace.org. All right, so do this for me. Would you picture a video gamer in front of an Xbox or whatever playing their game of choice? The first thing you notice is probably not their innate sense of style and fashion. But maybe you ought to, because with the rise of esports and live stream gaming, so too has come live stream style. Luke Winkie wrote about it in the New York Times today. Luke, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai. I appreciate it.
So how did it come to be that gamers and esporters, if you will, are now worried about how they look?
You know, it's something that kind of took me by surprise as well. I mean, I've covered the industry for a long time, and I've seen kind of inklings of it, but it was really kind of last month where I was walking around an esports tournament in Poland, and I saw that all the kids that were there attending were all dressed in young, hip, kind of athleisure, kind of streetwear, and that's kind of what first made me kind of aware that there was some sort of sea change going on. If I could identify it to one thing, I would just say that gaming is sort of, it's become something that pretty much all young people do in a way where it used to be kind of an appendage of nerd culture.
And I think we have to talk about this platform Twitch too, right? Which is a live stream platform for esports that, I mean, it's huge.
Yeah, it's massive. You know, like I think we cite in the story that in January last year, Twitch, in terms of total concurrent viewership, peaked higher than a channel like CNN or MSNBC and stuff like that. There's a lot of young people tuning into Twitch, which, I mean, if for the unaware, it's basically a platform where people stream video games, esports tournaments. Obviously, that's why I think a lot of companies are kind of taking notice and trying to invest into that community, considering how many young people are watching it right now.
As you said, it's the biggies, right? It's Champion, it's Adidas, it's Nike, and they're also going like high fashion as well, Balenciaga and Gucci.
Yeah. A lot of really kind of high fashion brands. There was a great story written by a friend of mine and a reporter, Nicole Carpenter, I think about a year ago, about an Overwatch League, how a lot of the people, Overwatch is a video game, and how a lot of the competitors in there were wearing $1,000 sneakers. It's
wow.
Really become, I guess the best comparison would be kind of the way the NBA has kind of changed in terms of its sort of take on style. You're really seeing kind of the same thing in esports right now.
Well, that's the other thing, right? As these tournaments become more lucrative, which is going to happen as esports becomes bigger, then it's just going to be a more attractive draw for these companies to want to get in on it and be seen and be on uniforms and all of that stuff.
Yeah, and I think, like, you know, it kind of even goes beyond fashion itself. Like, there was a quote from someone at Netflix a couple of months ago that said that their biggest competitor wasn't other sort of media streaming platforms. It was Twitch and Fortnite. It was kids tuning in to watch Twitch. And I think there's sort of this attitude in fashion, in pretty much any industry that, you know, caters to people tuning in or watching, that they need to kind of put their money into esports, into gaming right now if they want to reach, you know, this sort of incoming sort of Gen Z demographic. And I think you're seeing that attitude pretty pervasive in a lot of different industries right now, and particularly the fashion industry.
Luke Winkie writing in the New York Times today about, the headline of the article is The Rise of Live Streamer Style. Luke, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it, man.
This final note on the way out today, which I cannot even tell you how much I love. It's a job opening listed by the Cabinet Office of the British Government. Quote, Governor of the Bank of England, appointing department, Her Majesty's Treasury. Sector, business, finance, and skills. Location, London. Number of vacancies, 1. Remuneration, £480,000 sterling. Bank of England Governor Mark Carney is due to leave his job at the end of next January, so I suppose Her Majesty's Treasury is getting a head start. But come on, this is like posting a want ad for the Fed chair. We should call Jay Powell, see how he feels about that. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials down 134 today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ up 16, that's 0.2%. S&P 500 basically flat on the day. Amir Bowing, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bikella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.